Okay, so the global minimum of this function is 0.7, and then exactly value is 0. So this is a Bayesian mathematical, right? So if we cannot trust the tool to optimize this function, how can we trust it to optimize this function? Well, let's try a third proof. Now, Thomas Helty understands these concerns, the person who wrote the proof. So he started a project which he called the Flyspeck project, so this is a formal proof of the Kepler conjecture. And he wants to formalize this, his proof. So in a minute I'll tell you more about this. But first let's take one step back and ask yourself, what is the proof? So here's an example, which you all have seen. Gauss proof is a kid, that the sum of the first n integers is n times n plus 1 divided by 2. He proved this by writing out the first n integers in one line and then in reverse order. And in every column, the sum is n plus 1. You have n columns, so two lines, so this is the result. This generalizes, of course, to the quadratic case, so you can write a similar formula. You write the first n square numbers and in reverse you add up by the same argument to get this. Then you have an example of this theorem you just proved for n equals 3. Get this and this, and you conclude that 14 equals 15. So what we're drawing here is that this, of course, is not a proof because we have left out some details here. So I just said, if you don't believe me here, just go home, do the work. I don't have that time right now, but in fact, it's not true. So I'm sure you would have noticed this rather quickly, but the point here is that just by looking at this picture here, we cannot really tell why this is a proof and this is not. We need more details. So to push things even further, here's how the proof should actually be done. So we do an induction, right? Then we replace by the induction hypothesis. So we have split the sum into two parts, then apply the induction hypothesis, and then there's an algebra. Okay, so the answer to the question, what is the proof, is my claim is a proof is an object that can in principle be refined to another proof. And this process continues, and then you converge to something I would like to call a formal proof. Now, what is a formal proof? The first attempt to define this was made in 1879 by Frege in his Begriffsschrift. So I have an example here of a proof in Begriffsschrift. This is a fairly simple theorem, but she notes out all the details and has a funny notation and diagram. So basically it's a tree. You prove all the leaves, and then by implication, this makes up the whole theorem. Now, you can only prove small theorems in this way because we don't have enough paper and time. Now, with the arrival of computers, this changed. In 1967, de Bruijn wrote a system which is the Automat system, and he gave many formal proofs of basic mathematical results. And our favorite system is the Fock system, which is particularly well suited to also integrate computation and proofs. I'll show you an example of the theorem we just saw, and let's prove it in Fock. Now it's about natural numbers. Nat is the type of natural numbers. And the definition of a natural number is here. So it's either O, that is 0, or a successor of the mother number. So natural numbers are O, SO, SSO, and so on. Now we define the function, the first n integers, by inspecting n. So the sum of the first n integers, if n is equal to 0, 0. If n is equal to, if the successor of n prime, then it's the sum of the first n prime integers plus n. Now we can compute. So this is just a programming language here, right? A little strange one, perhaps. It's a functional programming language. And now we can prove a theorem about the function we just defined. So for the sum of 10 is 55, of course. And this is just the formal proof of the slide I just showed you. So how does this work? When you say here lemma, so the two is went on the left side here, it's a little bit more easier. The system comes up here with a goal. And now we can apply so-called tactics to transform this goal. So we say, I want to show this by induction. Then it leaves me with two goals, one for n equals 0 and one for the successor of 0. In the first case, we can just simplify and prove a better reflexivity. And in the other case, we have an induction hypothesis here, which we can use. Now we have to apply the distributivity law here to make this appear here. And now we can rewrite with the induction hypothesis to replace this term by this. And the rest is just algebra. So there's a tactic called ring, which does this. Now the proof is done. Okay. So you might find this laughable, but I'll show you some examples in a second. First of all, a quick remark. We've seen computer-assisted proofs already in this workshop by Gianni Arioli, Sheldon Newhouse, Alex, and others. I probably didn't notice. They use computers to find proofs. Now, this is different. By computer-assisted proof, I mean proof that is checked by a computer. Now, proof assistants are themselves software. So the program I just showed you, the system, it probably contains bugs. So why should we trust them? Well, there are two answers. They are written very carefully in a way that the code in which bugs matter is very small. It's a kernel. So by software architecture, the risk is minimized, and they are very well tested also. And there's been another project to formalize Coq in Coq, so prove the system in itself. Okay. Now, what about big proofs? So the most simple optimization technique for proving this kind of things is just cutting the interval x in 0 to 1 in n pieces. Then we make an interval evaluation over each of these intervals. And if it's non-negative in every case, then the theorem is proved. Now, for n equals 2, 5, 10, we might do this at n. For n 20, 50, perhaps if it rains outside and it's Sunday afternoon, you might want to do it, or you give it to a student. If n equals 1,000, well, depends. But what's strange here, there seems to be an n where something changes, right? We can't do it by hand anymore, but we need a computer. So my claim is, that doesn't matter. Because there's no largest n such as this is a proof. If there was one, you just add one, and there's no threshold. There's no good argument for a threshold here. So at some point, you need to rely on tools, like we rely on papers and pencils. Why not rely on computers? And there have been examples for very large n's. So the four-color theorem, for example, has been shown in Coq, so that every planar map is colorable with at most four colors. And there are also formal proofs that some very large prime numbers are prime. Okay, so let's talk about Taylor models finally. This brings me to my second part. When you want to put proofs inside the computer, that is, formalize them, we have to be very careful about the definitions. First of all, they need to be detailed. And if we want to deal with these tactics, they also have to be very simple in a way. So here's an attempt to define Taylor models. So a Taylor model is a polynomial with an interval, polynomial in n variables. And the function is said to be a member of this Taylor model if for every d in the domain, for every x in the domain, f of x minus p of x is inside the arrow part. So I found that the right a tool to reason about Taylor models are Chebyshev balls. So by Taylor of n, it's a polynomial with renumber. And we say a function is a member of the Chebyshev ball if, well, if a function in the supremum norm is close to the data. So Chebyshev does not refer to Chebyshev polynomial T, but to the Chebyshev norm, this norm. And this just notes pointwise abstraction. This is also a feature of theorem provers that you have to be very precise. You cannot just write minus, you have to use some other symbol if you want to have a pointwise abstraction. And of course they are connected, it's just Chebyshev balls are just centered Taylor models. And why you do this? Because when with this definition we can reuse all the lemmas about the Chebyshev norm. So when you want to prove something about Taylor models, let's look at the corresponding Chebyshev ball first and then do the proof. Now what is an extension to this? To the Chebyshev balls or Taylor models, same thing. If we have an operator on R functions and R Chebyshev balls, whenever these guys here are inside these, then also this holds here. And by list, I mean just a pointwise extension. That is, instead of functions, of R functions here, we have R real numbers. So as an example, arithmetic. Here are lists from of plus and times, so this is all very well known. By this two bars, I note polynomial bounding. In the original papers, I think you have three polynomial bounds here. So I went to Martin on Tuesday very proudly that I found a different formula with only one bounding, but two new variables, and he told me that's actually how it's implemented in COSY. So, but still, I would like to prove this thing, and here is how it is done with in the Chebyshev norm. So we make define two functions, d1 and d2, which denote the difference, and well, this is just algebra, right? Now the argument here is we can split this in two parts. And we know the range of d1 and d2 by definition is delta 1 and delta 2. So we can replace this by two new variables, delta 1 and delta 2, in this range. And then this is the optimization problem, which is solved by the polynomial optimizer. We can push this further now for the intrinsics. So intrinsic C2 by functional composition. So we extend now the composition symbol. The brackets here mean just I make a distinction between the polynomial and its function. So P is the list of coefficients and brackets of P is the associated function. Is it clear that this has this type? It's just it means you take a function on the left, one on the right, and as a result you get this one. So we go from R to N to R, and then from R to R, that is from R to N to R. And this is a Chebyshev ball in one variable, which is the one we are going to list, the intrinsic function. Now there's not so much time left, so perhaps I will go over the proofs, but the point here is where the Chebyshev metric really serves. So, for example, it is a general lemma that by composing with F here, we decrease the value of this thing. Okay, now for the intrinsics, as an application, if G is an intrinsic we're interested in, we just take this as a list. And it's only partial application, which means that in the previous definition here, if we fix one of the arguments here, then the property of extension is preserved. So when you fix one argument, we get a function with R minus one argument, and it's still an extension. That's true in general. Oh, sorry. Now the remaining problem is of course to find a G, that a big G that such that a small G is contained. And this is polynomial approximation, so there are several ways to solve this. Bernstein used his polynomials to prove the Weierstrass approximation theorem. They work in the continuous case. No smoothness is assumed here, but the convergence is really bad. Taylor models, we all know that they work well. One little concern though, they are particularly good locally. It has been suggested to use Chebyshev polynomials. The problem is, to my knowledge, and I discussed this with Johnny yesterday, I've never seen a formula which bounds the remainder of a Chebyshev polynomial. Perhaps I'm just ignorant, but all the formulas I've seen are of the type there exists an M such that, but we don't know the M, so in practice they're not so useful. The bound between the function I want to approximate.
So when you approximate
the
function.
Yep. So they're only theoretical bounds, but not numerical ones. And then there are Riemann's polynomials, which allow to. So this problem has an optimal solution. It's the Riemann's polynomial. And I'll say more about Taylor and Riemann in a minute.
Optimal in what way?
With respect to the Chebyshev norm. It's not conserved, yeah, that's correct, yeah. But it might in practice be really better, we don't know. So, I'll say more about that in a minute. Just the notation for the Taylor model?
It bounds for a general non-smooth
move
function you're approximating,
or
other function
you're going to. You refer to which one?
In Chebyshev.
Oh, we don't do Chebyshev, we can't, because there's no, we don't have a bound.
Generally, are you approximating smooth functions?
Well, in practice, we are interested in smooth functions, I think, yes. Okay, so I would like to hear that later, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Really interesting. Okay, so I like to write these things as operators. So T is the operator on the function G, which gives its polynomial. R is the rest, and L is the Lagrange remainder. This is subtraction on integrals. What says Taylor's theorem, or Taylor's theorem of Lagrange remainder, that the rest is inside the Lagrange remainder, or in our notation, G is inside the Taylor model of G with Lagrange remainder G. Perhaps you notice there is no additional theorem necessary here. Instead, we can move the value of A. If we pick the constant part of the argument polynomial for of the argument Taylor model for A, we get the same result. But computer scientists are really lazy people, so we don't like to look up the formula for the for each function, but just do this. But it's equivalent to the other formula. Now, it's actually one improvement we can make. If we manage to show that the remainder of G, and that is the actual remainder, the difference between the function and its approximation, is of constant sign, then the extension is just on the bounds, right? So let's try to do this. So the sign of the derivative of R is the same as R of the derivative, so R and variation commute. I will show that in a minute. Then we can apply Lagrange theorem and unfold it and simplify. And what we get is the result which says that so this thing here applies, that is, if the L derivative of G is a constant sign, and this, so there are different ways to deal with this, but the a simple observation is that if L is even, then we can forget about this and we just have left it with it. So this is the simple criterion.
Wait, so what is capital A?
That is X1, X2. Yeah, sorry.
But, yeah, okay, but that, you know, what is X1, X2 then?
That is the domain I want to approximate the function on.
No, that's not right. But you could.
Okay.
The way, so you have to calculate the Lagrange remainder for the range of the incoming polynomial.
Yeah, that is correct.
Oh, so x1, x2 is the range of the polynomial then?
Yes, I formulated the problem first in a way which here the range is not mentioned here because that can be separated conceptually, but in practice when you apply it to tele models, x will be the range of some f.
Actually, the bigger problem is to determine the range of the incoming, the argument. That's in practice a harder problem than using that range and then applying Taylor's remainder or any other remainder.
Okay, I see. Okay, what we missed to be shown is that these two guys can commute. So, this is the proof. It's just fiddling with indexes and it's quite simple. Okay, I need to finish. What you perhaps noticed is there was no mention of Taylor's theorem to the point of where we decided to use Taylor models. So let's try to make another choice. The Riemann polynomial is there's an algorithm which is the Riemann algorithm and it computes the best approximating polynomial in the Chebyshev norm. Now the correctness proof of this algorithm is really hard. I don't even understand how it works, but luckily I don't need to, because if we obtain a polynomial out of somewhere which approximates G, then we can compute this by interval arithmetic, right, just by cutting down the domain, the error bound. And now, luckily, someone in Lyon already in Nathalie's team already implemented this thing, so I can import it. And because this is a replacement for Taylor theorem. So, as Martin mentioned, this is if I multiply two Chebyshev balls with Riemann polynomials, in general, the result will not be a Riemann polynomial, but this doesn't, it is still correct, but I have less. It's harder to deal with theoretically and prove things about convergence. Yet in practice, it might work. Well, it has to be tried. And the other thing is that Riemann's algorithm is really slow, and at least in comparison to Taylor. So we need to generate a lot of these Taylor approximations and then reuse them. So for that, we need a database and then to look. Okay, so I hope I can convince you to some extent that formal proofs are necessary if you want to rely on the results. So when we want to do mathematics with computers, then formal proofs are necessary. This is what I just said. I know it's useful, but I think it's true. And Chebyshev balls simplify some proofs. And finally, the Lagrange remainder often is not optimal. Thank you.
Questions? So, as I understand it, the ones you describe, these proof checkers, do is you build a certain number of correctness along, just trying to.
Okay.
You build a certain number of statements that are part of your axioms or theorem that you have, and then you test certain statements, and it tests whether the given statement is true or not.
It is not a test in the sense that you test the theorem for 0, for 1, for 2, and then conclude that it's true for all. It's a purely syntactical manipulation in the sense that In order to check a formal proof like this one here, we don't need to understand what this means. You just have simple rules. Say, if I have this symbol here and this symbol here, then this symbol is justified, and so on.
So you have some implications that are in your system, and it just goes and does a search and compares which ones to build a chain of implications.
Exactly.
That's what it does. I see. So
So it's purely practical. There's no system does not understand the meaning of the statement.
Actually, a little bit connected to this, I know very little about these proof checkers, but I know even a very tight remainder bound. So then, do they actually? Okay, when you try to reduce a complex statement into known statements, is that done in a systematic algorithm that attempts to find things that can be, you know, locally simplified, or is this more like a mathematician who makes a random search of trying to combine things cleverly to get to the result? So is it just, if it, you know, if it's systematic, then it's just a matter of having enough computer power. On the other hand, if it's you know what I mean.
You actually refer to one of the problems Hilbert gave at the beginning of the last century. Is there a program which can decide for any given mathematical theorem whether this is true or not? Gödel showed that it is wrong. So we have to contribute our brain as mathematicians to the proof. And so the answer is at the core, it's the mathematician approach. That is, you have to say to the system, induction, rewrite, do this and this. But on top, we can construct automatic procedures which do these things and try them out and see if they work or not. And then we get more powerful tools, like as an example here in the last line, to show that this equals this, you need to automatically apply distributivity, commutativity, associativity, and so on. So ring is a very powerful tactic, and that would be the second case. A few things. So the dilemma you've seen on the first slide has been proved, but there are holes in the proof. So there are some lemmas which haven't been proved. The computing power of So the system, if you write programs like this, you're a little bit handicapped. And that was the main concern. So 10 years ago, that the technology wasn't at the point where we could do these things. Now we can formalize Taylor models, write Taylor model algorithms in this programming language, and that is already something nice.
Great.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, if you
have any
Everybody